Well, hi everybody, good morning. Thank you for your patience while the technical team get everything sorted out. Obviously quite a big undertaking here at TechEd, and I suspect running all the workshops, getting all the workshops up and running is quite a bit of a stress. I'm Martin Cocker, I'm the Executive Director of NetSafe, and I'll be your presenter, host, guide, whatever else you want to call me by the end of the session, feel free, to this session on designing trustworthy stuff. And the concept of the session came about, or we've been running sessions like this as long as I've been with NetSafe, because when I started, I went to present to quite a technical audience, and we had a bit of a discussion about staff-related challenges, and someone yelled out, "You can't patch the wetware." So I'm telling you that now so that nobody yells it out in this session, because somebody yells it out in most sessions I'm in. You can't patch the wetware. And it got us thinking, you know, obviously our job at NetSafe is patching the wetware, is helping people to be more skilled in what they do. And, you know, I appreciate this is a very technical conference. You'll be here, you'll be learning all about pretty technical things, and this session will be a little bit of a different focus. But I think, you know, if any of this helps, then I think, you know, you could make significant gains in terms of your overall objectives for creating a more trustworthy computing environment. So, NetSafe, this is our goal. We're a safer, more secure online environment to encourage digital opportunity uptake, something like that. And NetSafe's role, NetSafe's a coordinator, a leader, a policy advisor, you know, all those kinds of things that good solid NGOs do. This is me. This is me when I'm looking serious. You will see that a fair few times during this presentation. These are different ways you can find me. Obviously, there's my email address. The NetSafe website has you know, a tremendous amount of information. I am on Twitter sometimes. I always think that Twitter's a bit like standing in a crowd yelling. I don't know that anybody ever listens to anybody, but you know, I'm there sometimes. And I have my own website, martinc.co.nz, if you want to see how the renovations on my house are going. They're going okay, if you don't want to go there. What I'm going to do and share with you is stuff that we've developed, our experience through running different services that NetSafe runs. And so some of the critical ones that NetSafe runs that are really relevant to this are these three. So Security Central is a website that we run as an education site. It's associated with the Cybersecurity Awareness Week. And it is advice for consumers and small businesses on security. So it's very non-technical advice. You know, it's how to, you know, create a strong password and you know what a firewall does and things like that. But it's more our experience in terms of creating the messaging and trying to find ways to get messages through to people that's relevant from that. The Learn Guide Protect thing is straight out of our education work. So we have a job to raise youngsters, young kids, to be digital citizens, to be effective digital citizens. And there's a program called Learn Guide Protect that's part of that, and I'll explain that later. And it's kind of quite useful kind of theoretical framework for us to work with. And then there's something called the Orb. if you've been to the Orb, that probably means that you've been a victim of a cybercrime or cyber offence. The Orb is a cybercrime reporting site we run with the law enforcement agencies of New Zealand. And that's very useful to us because we see what scams and what things New Zealanders are falling for and why. So what I wanted to do is start with a brief history lesson. I didn't do history at school, so I'm not sure exactly how history lessons are supposed to go. But the history that we're talking about is in our lifetimes. So we don't really struggle to remember this stuff. But we wanted to start by saying, you know, this is not what we're talking about. You know, teaching staff to have better security behaviors or better behaviors with our ICT is not a new problem. You know, those of you who are statistics whizzes, maths whizzes, or maybe it's calculus, I don't know, will work out that instead of, assuming this is a four-digit PIN, this gets quite a bit more complicated if it's a five or six-digit PIN, but it's a four-digit PIN, I understand that there's 24 possible combinations on that keypad rather than 10,000. And, you know, it's likely that they all use the same one. And, you know, you would see this in a lot of locations, a lot of businesses, a lot of industrial centres in New Zealand. You see a worn-out keypad, you know. What we know is that people are comfortable with the status quo and that they don't consider the likelihood of a black swan event happening to them. almost everybody who we talk to at NetSafe comes to us after the event. That's a useful thing to know. So almost everybody that we're talking to has already been a victim of a crime. That's why they're talking to NetSafe. So they're not coming to us and saying, I don't want to fall for a scam. Tell me how not to fall for scams. They come to us and they say, I fell for a scam. Tell me how to get my money back. The answer is you don't get your money back. You know, when you fall for a scam, you put it at Western Union, it's gone. You know, congratulations, that's the end. So most people come to us after the event, after they've been hacked, after they've been scammed, that kind of thing. And this is because we already know that we should protect ourselves online, but we choose not to. And there was an article in Wired magazine that was a behavioral economics article, and it said, humans are hardwired to prefer small near-term pleasures over big long-term benefits. Throw in the possibility you might not actually ever need a strong password or a computer backup, and it's no wonder people are so lax about security. But humans are hardwired to prefer small near-term pleasures over big long-term benefits. So that's what you're up against when you're thinking about creating a trustworthy environment. So just returning to our history lesson, this is a cliff, this is an ambulance, and that's essentially where we started to get to in the security business. You know, people like yourselves parked your ambulance at the bottom of the cliff and just waited. And as I mentioned, NetSafe is, you know, there most of the time, and people have fallen off the cliff regularly, and we're picking them up. Obviously, the term ambulance at the bottom of the cliff is not used positively. It's a term people use negatively. So we've got to assume that that's not actually ideal, to park your ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. And people use the term, an inch of prevention is worth a pound of cure. No, wait, can't be an inch and a pound. Those are two different measurement systems. I've completely got that cliche wrong. But that cliche is used positively, the right one. And so what we thought is, instead of, you know, as a community, what we thought is, instead of building putting our ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, we'd create a nice fence. And this is a nice fence, you know, a nice picket fence. And it's a symbol. This is a fence. It's a boundary. The idea was that, you know, people would be allowed to climb over the fence, but they wouldn't want to. They would understand the value of the fence, and they would understand the reason that we'd put a fence there. It's like a symbol that we use to keep people on the right side of the right behavioral side of the equation, you know. And it seemed like a logical approach. Put this nice little fence at the top of the cliff. It's quite respectful. It's not offensive. It's not confrontational. You know, it was a relatively cheap and cost-effective way to keep people in or keep people on the right side. You know, and it wasn't hideous. But the problem was that people kept climbing over our fence. So we upgraded our fences, built some slightly more hardcore ones. And of course, this is quite a nasty looking fence. And when we're using this, when we're talking about, you know, controlling internal issues and turning staff, and we're using this kind of approach, these really, really aggressive fence type approaches, what we end up with is this equation, which is where we're currently at. And just for clarity's sake, he is the computer security expert, and that is everybody else. Yeah, I'm not listening. And so that's really where we're at. That's the end of this history lesson, I think. I don't think there's any... Yes, it's the end of the history lesson. That's where we've got to. You have got an important message to sell to the staff within the organizations that you work, and they're simply not listening. They've disengaged from the messaging. So I'm going to tell you some, I'm going to start with some theoretical stuff. I actually think this is probably the more valuable stuff. You probably take more away from the theoretical stuff than the rest, but this is the theory stuff. Starting with this concept of the cyber challenges. So when, you know, I talk about cybersecurity, we talk about cyber safety, we talk about cyber crime. Actually, they're all just this block of challenges. And especially to less educated users, they all look pretty much the same. We differentiate them. We differentiate them like this. We say cyber safety is about people and their actions. Cybersecurity is about technology. Cyber crime is about criminal acts, or in the case of sort of internal challenges, we might just call them malicious acts. But actually, there's obviously a tremendous amount of overlap of all of those three. And those areas in the middle, like we define them differently or we see the overlap, but most of our audiences don't. But the really important part of this theoretical model is this, that each of us, as experts in our area, bring a different sort of expertise. So people who come from a background like most of the employees in my organization, they come from cyber safety, which means that they have educational, psychology, sociology, communications type skills. So that's brilliant for everything in that cyber safety area that's not overlapped with something else. You technology audience. Actually, I shouldn't label you technology audience. You could be anything from up here. You look like a technology audience, but your strengths are in, you know, technology, obviously, how technology works, and then user behavior type of understanding, how people follow things, how people use the software, how to do things. Over in the cybercrime area, you get people who have experts in enforcement techniques and law and regulation and criminal behavior, things like that. But in that middle space, each of us, each of our different groups, feels uncomfortable, logically, because you might be a technologist that doesn't make you a psychologist. And when you require that knowledge, you feel uncomfortable, or you're a little bit out of your depth. Or vice versa, the psychologist feels uncomfortable with the technology, the law enforcement people. Are there any police officers in here? That's a shame. A whole lot of jokes we're just going to leave out because of that. But police officers, obviously, you know, the average police officer feels very uncomfortable with technology. So when you're talking about cybercrime that is just simple cybercrime without any particular technological complication, they feel very comfortable, but as soon as you get into that overlap space, you get problems. So most of our challenges are actually in that overlap space. Okay, here is our theoretical model number two. This is the most basic model. You will see it all the time when you're doing creating new products or new systems, etc. You follow a process like this. You understand what's going on. You get some reporting out of that. You get some information out of that. You make interventions and enforcement type actions. You learn something from that. You make an improvement. You know, you watch the improvement flow. Now, this is the thing that we're actually piss poor at when it comes to the cyber challenges. We don't complete the loop very well. We make assumptions instead of analysis and research. And as a result of that, the reactions that we undertake tend to be a little bit weak. So there's a big focus at the moment on improving this, improving the information that's available to organizations who are trying to understand what is the ideal reaction to the challenges. If you're an organization that creates a big set of data around cybercrime or cybersecurity, then it'd be great to talk to you later, because we have projects to combine different organizations' data so that we can start to make some get a real understanding of what we're doing here. The next model, one you'll be familiar with, next theoretical model, is the three E's of road safety: education, enforcement, and engineering. This often gets used when people are trying to work out how to create a new public health campaign. You use this. So it's pretty obvious. If you think of road safety, so some complicated message like wear a seatbelt, then there's education campaigns. We see pictures of people splattered all over their bonnet because they didn't wear a seatbelt. Police officers will stop you and give you a ticket, apparently, for not wearing a seatbelt. And there's obviously also engineering. The seatbelt manufacturers put them in the cars. That's pretty handy. And in terms of road safety, again, you know, engineering, we have better roads, better cars. You know, we have police out there telling us not to speed. We have education campaigns about speeding. This is how it works. You have these three chunks: education, enforcement, and engineering. And when they combine well, you get positive improvements, positive outcomes. So I'm going to make some assumptions. Feel free to yell out if I'm wrong, but I'm suggesting that you're pretty comfortable with the engineering side of that equation. Most of you understand how to build systems that stop people doing things, if you have to, or restrict them in some way. And so I'm not going to talk to you about that. I suspect you'll go to lots of sessions at this conference about that. When it comes to enforcement, there is an important thing that you need to know about enforcement of rules in a business in New Zealand. So assuming that you want to take some action against a staff member, so we'll go to the extreme end, you want to take some action against a staff member for breach of the rules, of the ICT-related rules within a business, or security rules within a business, you need to prove three things. Firstly, there were rules. So, it's no good to say everybody knew that you should have a password. You actually have to write down everybody has to have a password. Secondly, and this has been tested in case law, so this is the next thing, this is an important part of it, as well as rules, you have to have shown that you've tried to explain the rules to people so that they would understand them. So some things that are obvious to us won't be obvious to everybody, and if it's not obvious to the judge in the court who's hearing the case, then your case will be thrown out. You shouldn't have dismissed that employee. And the third thing is that the behavior that you say, the rule, has to be normative. So there was a good example in New Zealand. It was related to Air New Zealand. It's a case you can look up. It goes back a few years. and some employees were looking at pornography on the computers, and they were when the action was taken against the employees, the employees were dismissed, and then they were reinstated. And the reason they were reinstated by the court is that Air New Zealand couldn't show, one, that they'd properly educated people and they shouldn't look at porn, and two, I'm oversimplifying that, and then two, everybody was sharing passwords within the organisation, and so the behaviour that they were saying that they were penalising these people for was actually normative in the organisation. So you have to have those three things: rules, education, and then those rules have to be followed, essentially become normative. So the good news is that that's a heavy overlap with the next thing that we're looking at, which is sort of the education of non-malicious acts. So most of the challenges that we face are not deliberate internal attacks, they're accidental errors by staff members, or they're mistakes by staff members. Mostly, of course, what we're talking about is we actually need the same thing. So those three things that are required if we want to take enforcement action are also the three things that we need if we want to create culture change and success in terms of creating trustworthy staff. So as I said, NetSafe sees a lot of people who are scammed or who lose money. They get socially engineered, they send money to people they don't know or businesses that don't exist. Why is it that people fall for scams? That's why I was thinking, why do people fall for scams? It's a pretty big question, lying in bed at night, why? One of the messages that we use when we talk to consumer audiences is, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. But what we see is sometimes things that are just good, not really too good to be true, but aren't. Sometimes we see scams that actually don't even really look like good deals, but are scams. And the problem is that when we create these simple catchphrases, they oversimplify the problem. And people think that a scam will be obvious because you'll see it and it'll be too good to be true. Then when the scams are not too good to be true, people don't recognize them as scams. Well, so why is it that we use these sort of phrases all the time in our campaigns? Stop, think, click. swim between the flags. Look left, look right, and look left again. That's one my kids know about crossing the road, apparently. Speed kills. Why do we use those sort of slogans, and why do we want to use them in ICT computer security? The reason we want to use them in ICT security is because they worked on those other occasions, or they seem to work. I mean, swim between the flags, we all know what that means. Speed kills, we know what it means. But why don't these stop, think, click type simple slogans work with computer security? Basically, slogans, these kind of slogan campaigns, they're effective if people have... If they capture existing knowledge. So if you were able to get somebody and just pull them out of a social vacuum and they'd never spoken to anybody and you said, speed kills, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. The only reason we understand what speed kills means is because we understand that, what is the speed limit, and then you just drive too fast, and we understand the concepts of increased momentum, increasing force, and all those kinds of things. Perhaps not quite that depth. But those sort of slogan campaigns, they work well if they capture existing knowledge. If the knowledge isn't there, it doesn't work. So if you think of stop, think, click for the average user, stop, okay, that's something people understand. I stopped. Think what? Do I want to click? Yes, click. We think, oh yeah, what you should think is you should think, is this the right thing, whatever. It's not necessarily what the average user thinks. So when I was thinking about that, I thought, well, people fall for scams a lot, and quite reasonable people fall for scams, we find. And so perhaps what we could do is we could do some learnings from the crooks. So we could look at some common scams that NetSafe sees, we see people come in, and then we could see what the sort of underlying, why those scams work. What is the psychological, educative concept of them that works? So wetware issue. Social engineering. People... get an email from their bank or from Trade Me asking for credit card details, driver's license numbers, passwords, whatever. Most people don't fall for it, but a few people do. So what do we learn? So let's just take the Trade Me example. What do we learn from that scam, those scams that hit Trade Me or Trade Me users, I should say, rather than Trade Me? What's the interesting things from that? Well, firstly, interdependence is an interesting thing that we learn from that. Obviously, you know, every time someone gets scammed, every time a TradeMe account gets rolled into a scammer's hands or an email account, lots of other people get affected by it. So there's an interesting issue of interdependence in here, but that's not particularly that helpful to us. People exit the site quite readily from TradeMe. So I suspect that if many of you as educated ICT users, if you were in a TradeMe trade and someone said to you, hey, why don't we take this outside the TradeMe site and complete the trade out there? That would be a red flag to most of you. You would think, why is this person trying to exit the safety of the TradeMe site? Is this person a scammer? You would probably ask yourself that question, but obviously the people who fall for these scams, they don't. Why not? Because they don't know about the safety systems that are inside TradeMe. They're invisible to them. TradeMe has built this incredible trust and safety capability most users don't know it exists. So they don't know why they're safer inside TradeMe than they are out. So invisible safety is not actually particularly effective as an education tool. So we do need to bring what we do out of the shadows. We do need to understand that if we're going to do something for the safety of our employees, that we need to show them what it is, tell them what it is, so they recognize that it's there, that we've done it for them, we've done it for a reason. We had a person ring and they told us that they'd lost control of their farm. They'd been hacked and they'd lost control of their farm, and we thought, oh, this is exciting. It's one of them smart farms, you know, it's someone's taken over the technology of their farm. But it turned out that it wasn't. It was just Farmville, which is a very technological farm, of course. And this person had spent many years, they'd been farming their Farmville farm, and they'd spent many years on it, and they were pretty upset that their Facebook account had been hacked. I mean, of course, someone had just guessed their password. And Facebook wasn't particularly worried about saving their farm, and their crops were dying, and it was, you know, it's quite a tragedy. The lesson from this is people value different things. Like, we're laughing, because we're like, you know, like it's a virtual farm. But for this person, it was traumatic. They were so upset that their farm was going to be destroyed. People, they value different things. So some people value their Farmville farm. And the other thing is that people, they value what they've invested in. I mean, that's the thing about a Farmville farm or a game that you've been playing for years, and then your, you know, hard drive dies and you spend all this time trying to recover it. You know, you value it because you made an investment in it. But if someone else made the investment, you don't feel so inclined. So it's important that people feel as though they're invested in what we do, as well as that we feel invested in what we do. So we all know the scam where you get called or get an email. I'm jammed up. I'm in London. Send me some. I lost my wallet or whatever. Send me some money. It's a remarkably effective scam. Lots of people fall for this. It's more believable if the person who sends you the email is actually travelling to that region. If you knew that the person wasn't in that region, if I got an email from my brother and said, I'm in London, send me some money, I would know he's not in London. I don't think he has a passport, so I'm not going to send the money. But if he was travelling, I'm more likely to fall for it. And of course, the lesson in that is about personalisation. It's about having the message that matches the person's experience and knowledge and understanding, I think. We've seen quite a lot of this, which is, you know, scammers jumping online and in real time impersonating somebody and running that exact same scam. I think the interesting thing for this, for me, is, I mean, it's remarkable when you think about it. How could somebody replicate somebody you know well online? You know, but anyway, it does work. And part of the reason it works is because people don't think criminals could be this brazen. Because we assume people are like us. We assume people have the same kind of fears and motivators and that kind of thing as us, and we don't think, well, this person would be just so bold as to get online, pretend to be someone else, and then just ask me for money. Sometimes you need to challenge people's assumptions, because people's view of the world doesn't prepare them for the challenges that they face. So I just want to, I suspect the percentage of this audience would be quite high. Who here has bought an item from overseas because it was cheaper than buying it in New Zealand? Okay. So, is any of those, did anyone buy a tractor? Well, one unlucky guy did, or tried to, and he bought a tractor. It was a good deal. It was quite a bit cheaper, and all he needed to do was, you know, buy it from somewhere else. I can't remember. It might have been the UK. And then it was going to be shipped over. Unfortunately, it got stuck in Madagascar. you know, the story, and it needed some money to clear the, he's paid a 50% deposit or something, but it's, you know, started to incur these clearance costs at the port and all that sort of stuff. And then he realized that, you know, that he was being scammed and he was out of pocket. It was probably quite a bit flash attractive than that, actually, thinking about the money that he put on it. And the question is, do all online trades look the same? Well, they did to him. They might not to us, but they did to him. Because that was his experience was pretty limited in terms of online trading. And the difference was very subtle. But it does also come back to that thing about the messaging. You know, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. Well, that deal didn't look too good to be true. Shopping overseas gets you a bargain. I think we're sort of learning that. We're seeing that. You can buy cheaper stuff overseas. So everything's stacked up for this guy. Unfortunately, he was in a scam. And again, what this tells us is about people's experience. His limited experience in international trading meant that he didn't have enough experience about that sort of stuff to recognize the little differences in this particular trade that would have given it away as a scam. Not least of all the shipping route via Madagascar, which was a long way for it to come. Of course, one of my personal favourites, I'll say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek because they are terrible stories when they come in, the romance scam. Romance scam is the most effective return on your investment as a cyber criminal. If any of you are thinking of getting into cybercrime, let me point you to romance scams. Romance scams, they are quite a big investment in time. It does take a while, but the payoff is huge. Huge. Hundreds of thousands of dollars people will pay. And we've had millions, you know, paid to romance scammers. So what do we learn from romance scams? Well, firstly, we learn that love is expensive. That's whether you're in a scam or just love generally. It's an expensive thing, you know, think twice about it. But more importantly, romance scams talk to something which we've known about for a long time. Many of you would have been schooled in New Zealand. You may have had a similar schooling as I did. This is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. The concept of Maslow's hierarchy of needs is that you have particular needs, you have particular requirements in life, and as you achieve that level of satisfaction that you've achieved that level, you then desire the next level. There's some argument about the order, and there's an argument about whether those things are across different cultures and all that kind of stuff, but we won't get too much into that now. What we'll just do is we'll just focus on this. So the bottom level, is physiological, and the next level is safety, and the next level is love and belonging. Now here's the interesting thing. They target this love and belonging level, right, because the satisfied need does not act as a motivator. So what's interesting in that for us is that if people feel safe, you can't use safety as a motivator. Use something further up the hierarchy. That's the theory. So I feel quite safe. We all feel quite safe. Generally, New Zealanders feel quite safe because generally we are quite safe. So safety is a difficult thing to motivate us with. So scammers know, move up the hierarchy and target something that is we don't necessarily feel. We don't all feel loved. I mean, this is not what this session is about, but we don't all feel loved. And what happens, I would deduce that in developing countries, you would be able to target the safety and physiological needs if you're running a scam. I don't know that for certain, but I would suspect that that's probably true, because that's what people need. They need that thing, whereas we need love and belonging. And, of course, the variation on that we're seeing at this time, this is not one of those sessions, but Skype cyber sex sessions are becoming the... I have a very, very interesting job. You don't spend a day in my office. People, unfortunately, they jump online, they meet somebody they think is pretty hot, that person convinces them to take their clothes off, do some stuff, and they do the stuff, and then the person on the other end says, that's brilliant, I've recorded that, and pay me some money or I'll release that to your friends. And it's usually only $500 or $600, the first demand, and then it goes on basically until you stop paying. And what's interesting about this is the scam targets that love and belonging concept, you know, I'll give you some love and I'll give you a purpose to somewhat, but then the blackmail targets esteem, which is higher up again. because you're worried that you know your reputation is going to be destroyed by the release of this video. Did anyone see there was a story on this recently? And Tom Polistrica ran it in the Don Post, and there were some brilliant comments in it. And one of the guys said, you know, I've fallen for the scam, and then Tom found him and interviewed him about it. And it was a fascinating insight into the risks people take and the way that those things can go bad for you. But I did love some of the comments. One of them said, I haven't made one of these videos, but I'm thinking about doing it and blackmailing you all. Something like that, in case you see it. Anyway, I'm getting off topic. I'll stop it. So just a quite quick summary, you know. Our safety and security is dependent on others. People don't value invisible protection. People are motivated by different things, especially things that they've invested in. People who know the truth are less likely to fall for a lie. But people don't always cross-reference everything they're told. People see the world through the lens of their experience. And if people feel safe, then safety is a difficult thing to use as a motivator. Just want to quickly go back to school because, as I mentioned, we have this model, which I'm not even sure why that slides in there. I think it just looks more artistic than this one. We have this model called Learn, Guide, Protect, and we use it to help school educators understand the concept of starting somebody from the beginning of their school life, taking them through to the end of their school life. Now, in some ways, some of our staff are a bit like this. They're like, maybe not quite year zero kids, but they're like those kids who come into school and their understanding of their environment is limited. And what we talk about is these three aspects of a safety program for kids. You've got protection, technological measures, engineering. You've got guidance, and then you've got learning. Right? And of course, your objective as a teacher is to set somebody free from the schooling system, not needing guidance or protection anymore, that they've fully learned the thing. So if you look at the model there, over time you can see that protection drops away. You know, technology stops being a significant part of this equation. There's a guidance factor, which is, you know, parents and teachers showing kids how to be safe online. And then as the young people, as they learn the skills, they become capable of managing their own challenges. So in some ways we have a similar challenge in the in our workspaces, in terms of understanding that there is a time factor associated with this. We have to move people from this level of limited personal skills through to completely self-managing, and that there are these other factors involved in that, one of which is, you know, technology and protection, and then the other is our guidance, how we show people what to do. This is another model just from the schooling space, in here more for interest than for anything else, so those of you who are parents will be interested in this. This is a concept of a digital citizen. It sort of replaced the traditional cyber safety type programs, because cyber safety, as we found, wasn't particularly motivating for a lot of young people, but the concept of citizenship is quite motivating. And so there's three aspects to a digital citizen. There's your ability to manage your environment and remain safe, which we call cyber safety skills. There's a concept of digital literacy. I know how computers work and I know how to work them. And then there's this idea of values and competencies. So, you know, a citizen is somebody who has values and competencies consistent with your country. A digital citizen also has the sort of digital components put in. At this stage, I'll just do a quick recap. So we're understanding that our programs should be less of this, less lecturing, hopefully less enforcement required, not too much of this, and more of this feel-good stuff. No, not motivated by that, okay. So let's... It used to really motivate people in the 80s, you know? Come on, team, let's make a human pyramid. Nope, okay. Tough crowd, man. So let's talk a little bit about just putting that theory into action, taking some practical steps to build an education program. One of the things you need to do is you know, stand out a little bit. You need to have a communications campaign that has something which is a little bit innovative. You know, even like a, just look at this image, it stands out because kids don't wear that kind of clothes. So, you know, there's a sort of a basic marketing tip. But you know, obviously takeaways from this, you do need to set the rules. We do need to have an education program, and we do need to ensure that the activity that we're looking for is normative. we do want to try to create what I would call a digital citizenship style education program, so one that brings people into the program that understands some of those kind of different motivational factors that people have. Which means that your first step is to recruit these people, not these actual people, they are probably models. We went back to that theoretical model. These education programs require these kinds of skills: internal communications, public relations, marketing, human resources. I actually put those in sort of an order. If you're from a big company, you're probably going to start with your internal communications people. They are the people who are used to selling messages internally in the company. We're doing well. Don't worry about the financial result. We're still doing well. That's the internal comms people's job, right? So they're good at selling difficult messages, depending on your company. And then public relations people, again, good at spin. Marketing people, again, good at finding messages within the messages that you want to sell, finding messages that actually do sell. So, recruit those people into your campaign. Don't try to take on an education campaign yourselves. It's not your thing. Or it might be. You might be so multi-talented, you might be like, yeah, it's my thing, man. But if you're not, then this is necessary. Leverage the other opportunities. So lots of other people care about the same things you care about. Some of those things end up in campaigns. So Cybersecurity Awareness Week is an opportunity for you all to jump on board with, because NetSafe and its partners, including Microsoft, create resources and materials which you can use internally. And by leveraging this week, you're telling your staff, hey, think about security, and this is what security means internally at X company. At the same time that there's a media coverage about security, that there's good coverage about it, and it helps to build the message and understanding. So there's also Privacy Awareness Week, run by the Office of the Privacy Commissioner. There's Fraud Awareness Week. Lots of the messages in there, very consistent with the messages you're trying to sell. All of these weeks are about organizations creating resources that you can use. So, go ahead and use them. I wonder if this will work. I wonder what will happen when I do this. Oh, good. So, this is a Security Central website. So, has anyone seen the Security Central website? This is it here on my little screen. Hang on a sec. There's every possibility that one of these. Oh, there you go. It's like that. So what we did is we produced some videos, and so there's lots of resources in here. There's an Android app, no one downloads. Some research, or that's a video with me in it, so maybe we can avoid that video. So for example, for Phishing Friday, we created these videos, which you can download. I don't know if we'll wait for it to download. I don't even know if I've got audio attached here, actually. But the point of it is that we sounds great up here. So the point is that we use the community's money, ICT community's money, produce these kind of resources, and then make them available to people like you to use internally and to build your own campaigns around, thinking very much about what is specific to your organization. So, customizing those messages a little bit and finding hooks and things that people are interested in internally to make those things work. The other thing, oh God, stuff this. Just one moment. Right. The other thing which has become very clear, we talked a lot about people's experience, people coming to NetSafe only after they've had a bad experience. For years I resisted this concept, but it's become obvious that it's actually a necessary part of education campaign. You actually need to give people the experiences in a safe way that you don't want them to have in an unsafe way. So do think about running a scam internally. Do think about social engineering your staff. Now, this is where you really need the expertise of a good team around you, because you can get this very wrong and just totally offend everybody. Or it can go amazingly well if it's created as a very positive experience and does need a buy-in from the organization at a very high level. Because the ideal thing is like the CEO falls for the scam and you know admits that he wasn't up to it and we all need to improve our education, etc. But every time I've seen one of these run, they're remarkably effective at getting staff talking about the kinds of things that the kinds of ways that they could be targeted. Almost guaranteed. We should turn off the live streaming. Let's keep that a little secret. Almost guaranteed way to socially engineer the staff of your organization, sometime not long before bonus time, hopefully you've got a bonus time, or Christmas, just make one up, send them out an email saying that there's something happened related to their salary, something happened related to the bonus. All they've got to do is jump online, put some information in this form, fix it up, blah, blah, blah. Like massive hit rate. And then from that, you can explain how scams work, how these people will be targeted. Talk to them about what it is in the company that you're protecting, your intellectual property that's valuable to you, et cetera, and build a campaign off the back of that. So a summary. I feel like I've had a few summaries in this. Creating trustworthy staff, clear guidelines. We need education, which is obviously a bit of a fluffy subject, something other people are interested in, and therefore we have this do this list. Set clear guidelines, make sure the rules are clear. Recruit as many experts in the other fluffy stuff as you can. Leverage other people's work. That's us, Privacy Commissioner, Fraud Awareness. There's also a series of groups that you can belong to that also have quite a bit of expertise in this area. So whether that's ISACA or the NZI Internet Task Force or whoever, then you know, join up to them and find the people who are good at this. Create some experiential opportunities. And obviously don't allow or ignore the bad behaviours because that puts you in a difficult position. This is a required slide, related content. As far as I can see, there are no related content in this in this conference. And you'll find me later anywhere you like, really. I don't hide. Evaluate the session and you could win instantly. It's not usually my end slide, but it's the end slide, apparently. So how do we go? Oh, that's pretty good. Got a bit of time if anyone has questions or would like to question any of the theoretical models or just generally yell something out. Oh, did we win the America's Cup this morning? Did we win the race? First one? We were well ahead when I was in the car, but I don't know why I care. You know, you put just write New Zealand on the side of something, I'm right behind it. Doesn't matter who owns it. Questions?
So do you recommend running the scan or running the educational?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the scam, running the internal experience is a great starting point for any education campaign. Because it gives you something to refer back to in your education material. But, you know, I mean, I think if you talk to the HR people, they'll say, you know, run the education first, don't, you know. But I think, you know, it probably doesn't matter, but I would probably run the experiential thing first. As long as you can ensure that it won't be offensive to the staff, that they won't feel as though you've just, you know, hung some people out to dry and made them look stupid or whatever. That's the beauty of that salary bonus related scam. So many people will fall for it that it doesn't make individuals look really bad. Welcome to the company. This is how it's going to be here, you know. Get on guard. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if you feel you've got a good level of knowledge within the staff, then you know really it's just people you're bringing in which case you can target them with education. Okay. If there are no more questions, I will end the session 10 minutes early and you can go and do whatever it is that you need to do. Is there an Xbox One here? Is somebody? No? Oh, well, okay. I'll go back to NetSafe then. All right, thanks.